sweet pea.
It's about 9:30 a.m. and these kids have just come in from a morning of playing outside. Laura Peters, head of the Growing Footprints Daycare and the attached Empowered Kids Preschool, is watching little Zoya struggle to take off her shoes.
Oftentimes parents will come in and just take off shoes and socks for kids because it's easy and convenient and it's habit. But what we encourage the parents to do is to let the kids do it by themselves, even at 1 year old.
There you go.
Thank you, Nikki.
Can you put it in the basket, please?
How old is she?
She is 18 months.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect, and we thought this would be a good place to start today's show, here, where the first seeds of self-reliance get planted.
Our program is totally centered around teaching these kids to be self-sufficient.
And if one of those one-year-olds trying to take off his or her shoes got really frustrated and couldn't go on, at what point would you sort of just say, okay, let's try again later?
Nope, we don't. We finish with them. We do it.
You wait it out.
We wait it out, and we show them you don't give up. It's really not that difficult to navigate that. It's really not. It's tedious, but it's not difficult.
And then we are going to do our introductions.
Here's an example of what happens when you give a kid time to learn independence. Each morning they do circle time, and there each kid gives a little speech. It's Toastmasters for toddlers.
Okay, Nathan, go for it. This thing that we do, it took Nathan 2 years before he got the courage to do this, and so he's come a long way. Okay, ready? With a clear, speak clearly and loudly.
Hi. My name is Mason. I'm 2 years old.
You're two?
Three.
You're three. Yes? And what is your favorite color?
Red.
And what do you want to be when you grow up?
I want to be a daddy.
A daddy. Good job. Can everyone clap? Is everyone looking? All right.
Down came the wind and pushed the fire out.
Today on Sound Effect, self-government. From circle time all the way to a self-governing utopia right in the middle of a Seattle lake. We are going to be getting to that right after our autonomous collective of journalists freely assemble to talk over the week's news. And look, I know you're your own person, so I don't have any control over this, but I hope you will choose not to go away. We have convened the Brain Trust this week to dish about the week's news, and today we're welcoming back Tanya Mosley, who is an independent journalist here in Seattle. Justin Carter is founder and editor of Capitol Hill Seattle blog, and Kari Plogue covers East Pierce County for the Tacoma News Tribune. Hey guys, welcome to Sound Effect.
Thanks for having us.
So in a minute, we're going to hear about everybody's undercovered stories of the week, as well as our overcovered stories. But as for the top story, we're thinking about the Puget Sound region's housing crunch this week. And sure, that could be the top story most weeks. But this week, we had a few developments that made us think this is probably a good time to kind of catch up on where things are headed. So for starters, this week we learned that Seattle area home prices lurched up 7.5% over this time last year. It increased 2.3% in just 1 month. And that is number two in the country after San Francisco. Rents are going up nearly as fast. I just wonder, does it seem like anybody has any serious solutions at this point for this kind of runaway train? And I'm going to maybe start with you, Justin, since you have a pretty good microcosm of it up on Capitol Hill. How is this playing out? What have you been hearing lately in terms of ways to attack the rising prices of housing?
Well, we reported on some solutions this week. I'm not certain that they are the solutions, but there is definitely a wave of course, interest to solve this problem. And I think probably the most interesting thing, rather than the specifics, is just the idea that in a year where every city council seat is up for grabs, that renters' rights issues, of all things, are on the table and maybe the top of the table in a city like Seattle that's so wealthy and so successful. The renters' class seems to be maybe the keys of the castle this year.
That's interesting because in a lot of cases, the classic sort of politicking, you door knock on single family homes. You don't door knock on rented apartments, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen discussions about that very issue. How do you reach this voter block that may or may not even exist out there? And so it'll be interesting, too, is to see the turnout. You know, a lot of attention on renters' rights in the end might be political suicide.
Justin, I think it's really interesting the point you made about, is it political suicide for council members to bring this up as an issue? Because I find that more than half of the families I know are renters and are very much interested in this issue. I think that the perception of what the average renter is like and what the makeup is and the age shifts here in Seattle because it's so hard to become a homeowner in this city, in the city proper. So I think it will be interesting as the weeks and the months go on, how we see this all play out and exactly who is at the table and who will be speaking about this, who are renters.
Kari Plug, you cover East Pierce County and you live down in Tacoma. How does this issue play out in the South Sound? And is it anything like what's happening in Seattle with the runaway rents and runaway home prices?
I think that right now it's very affordable to not only rent in the Tacoma area, but also buy in the Tacoma area. I'm actually a homeowner. I've been a homeowner for almost a year now. But I think that there's a familiar narrative going on right now in the Tacoma area that Seattle is still dealing with, but dealt with a little bit ago. One story in particular that we covered this week is about Proctor Station. And Proctor is one of the more charming neighborhoods in Tacoma, and it's got a lot of old buildings and a lot of homeowners and not a whole lot of renters in the area. And they're building a six-story mixed-use, 150-unit building that people are not very happy about. And it's going to be very high-priced. They're going to charge extra for parking, so it could cause parking problems in an area that already doesn't have parking. And people are really scared that that's not only going to drive up prices for them, but also kind of rob them of the charm of their neighborhood that they've gotten so used to.
Neighborhood preservation, that is an issue that Tacoma and Seattle have in common, that's for sure. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that you're a new homeowner, because you're sort of making a pivot now, right? Did you rent before?
I did, yes.
So you're making a pivot from seeing this issue from a renter's point of view to a homeowner's point of view. And obviously, it's probably good for you if your home value goes up. So how's that been? Have you started to pay attention to this more? And do you see it differently?
I have been paying attention to it more. And actually, my mortgage is cheaper than my studio apartment was, which I was really shocked about. I had to do a double take when I was signing my papers. But it was really exciting because my house appraised for higher than it did when I bought it. And I think I bought it the right time and I was lucky and very fortunate. But it's definitely something as a former renter who was an avid voter that cared a lot about these issues. It's amazing to me that I care even more than I thought I could. So it's definitely something I'm paying attention to. My friends are paying attention to it. I have friends who are renters that are thinking about buying homes. And so kind of going back to what Justin was talking about, I think tapping into that renter vote is really important, especially since we're in this period of uncertainty in this region when it comes to this issue.
One data point, just a trivial point. I saw the when we did a sampling of the Craigslist listings for the last week, and we've been doing that monthly recently to kind of get a weather check. And the median for a studio on Capitol Hill right now is over $1,400 a month.
That's crazy to me because although when I was renting, it still felt expensive because I'm a journalist, so I'm on a journalist salary. Rent in Tacoma is nowhere near rent in Seattle. And I think there's a fear in the Tacoma neighborhoods that we're going to be there at some point. So
yeah. And Tanya, this is now becoming, as Justin said, a high priority in the citywide elections. But Mayor Murray has also said it's his top priority going forward, the next big sort of major policy priority period. And he has this panel that's scheduled to give recommendations. They were supposed to give them actually by this week. They got a 1 month extension. Do we have any sense about how, the big picture solutions are brewing? Like what might we hear about in the next couple of months?
Well, we definitely will hear about proposals for rent controls, and that's already been at the table very much so. And I know there's a lot of argument about that, but the reality is, even from my perspective, right now what you're seeing, especially when we talk about the Central District, there was a story that recently came out about the percentage of African Americans and that number shrinking. And what I find really interesting is if you really look deeper into those numbers, you'll also find that a number of minorities who are still living in the Central District are below the poverty line. So they fall under Section 8 housing. They fall under these other programs where they're able to live in those communities. And so there's this entire class of people who may be a lower middle class, who really can't afford to live in the Central District or other parts of Seattle. So I think that rent control is something that people really will be taking a hard look at.
Well, on that note, you consider that Central District trend to be something of an overcovered story, right? So what piece of it is overcovered? Is it just the focus on the city itself?
Well, I think it's overcovered because it's just part of the story. We're not looking at where those people are going, and it's been happening for quite a long time. If you look at the numbers and the numbers of folks that have been moving out, I mean, it's since 1972 that we began to see a steep decline over time, with the 80s being kind of a mass exodus. So this is not new. It's not like, oh, just last year we turned around and the Central District is now no longer majority Black. But with that, I don't think it's always an economic thing as well. I think that people take a look at the schools in that area. And if you can actually afford to live in the area, do you want to live in the area and have your children go to public schools that still deal with a lot of issues there? And so I think it's a little more complicated than that. I'd like to delve deeper into it and then also look at where people are actually moving to.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, joined by Tanya Mosley, Justin Carter, and Kari Ploeg. And we have sort of nudged our way into overcovered terrain here. So, Kari, maybe you could give us your overcovered story of the week.
So I might get in trouble for saying this as one of the official media sources of the U.S. Open. But one of the stories that I was surprised at the way it was covered was the closure of Chambers Bay to the public, which was no surprise to anybody. We've been talking about Chambers Bay for what feels like years now. And everybody knows this big golf tournament or championship is coming in a couple weeks. But I noticed that almost every media outlet had the public closure as a top story, which kind of surprised me because the average Joe doesn't normally have money or time to spend at Chambers Bay. I mean, Chambers Bay is kind of expensive. So it's not that we shouldn't have covered it. I just felt that we covered it a little bit too much.
Is this a case of like one of those things where it's a slow march to the actual news event? And so any handle you can get on it to report some little tiny little change is what this
season. Absolutely. And I feel like there are so many other angles that are people care about a whole lot more. Traffic being the number one thing. I think that's the number one thing you hear about when people talk about the U.S. Open. So bigger stories, I thought, should have maybe been more of the top story rather than the closure of the course itself. So,
well, we are definitely going to hear about some of those stories that we think ought to have been covered more. But Justin, why don't you give us your overcovered story first?
The media enjoys an opportunity to show everybody sometimes just how lame government can be, and especially the hapless government worker who does something silly. And so there was an explosion of coverage midweek around some lines that got painted incorrectly on I-5. it's such an easy story that, you know, I understand it from the inside, but from the outside, it drives me crazy when so many minutes are given to those kinds of stories. Mm. And the angles are off. They're so mean. I mean, if I just imagine the people who did it. I mean, hopefully it's kind of funny. Hopefully nobody really got hurt. But the coverage, I think, in the end, it's such a cynical look at what we do. Mm. And it frustrates me.
Well, now I feel bad because the first thing I thought of was like Wile E. Coyote painting the lines of the road, you know, right, off into a brick wall or something like that. Well, now let's move into our undercovered stories of the week. Tanya Mosley, what's your choice?
The story that I felt was undercovered comes out of Woodinville in the North Shore School District. And earlier this week, there was a school council meeting about threats made to three Black students at a middle school there. And what was interesting was parents were really upset with how the district had been handling it. These were real death threats, both online and in person. And the parents felt that it took a long time for the district to even acknowledge it. And when they did, they chose to bring in a mediator for the Black students and this student that was threatening these three students. And
this was a white student threats against three
Black
students.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that type of stuff happens. I think what I find really interesting in the story is, first of all, there was a huge presence of parents who came to the meeting. I mean, it was standing room only. But also this idea that school districts as a whole, I have found in my reporting that many parents have come to me to say, I feel helpless when it comes to racial bullying. And there seems to be this passive nature from many schools in how to deal with it because they're not sure how to deal with it. So I think it would be something to explore. And I think North Shore actually brought this to light for me.
All right. Well, thanks for that undercovered story of the week. Justin Carter, your turn. Undercovered.
So this will be a plea for assistance. We're covering a project that's not even in the neighborhood. If you don't know the site, I mean, we're extremely focused. We try and do only things that are Capitol Hill and very rarely do cross city things and especially things that aren't in the neighborhood.
Basically, we really have to bribe you to get you to come down to Belltown to our studios.
No, that's true. That's true. Or Tacoma. First time I've heard about Tacoma, so it's interesting to know that it exists. So. the convention center downtown, though, is this $1 billion project. It is going to be in a ginormous expansion. And there's been, I think, one or two television stories about it. I don't even think the Seattle Times has noted that it's happening yet. And this is the part of the process that matters. When it gets built and the construction, there'll be traffic and there'll be headaches. And that part of the story will also matter, but will matter in a different way. What's happening now is the public process to shape how it gets built, how it looks, and especially for Capitol Hill people, what it's like when we walk by it every day and go through it on our way downtown and back up and down the hill. And it's incredible to me. So looking at it from the outside, I don't always understand how TV and radio works, and I have not figured out exactly why this isn't a story for everybody. There's even really cool, pretty pictures of this amazing building that might be that they could show. And for some reason, though, I think it's just too complicated to share.
All right. Thanks for that. Kari Plogue, what is your undercover story of the week?
So mine is marijuana legislation, and not so much the frequency, because there's no doubt that we've been covering marijuana legislation frequently for a long time now. But it's more of the depth, at least the issues that we have now. So the two stories that are kind of circulating are the tax structure proposals in the House and the Senate, as well as the bill that was passed rolling medical marijuana into the recreational system. Both are very important issues, but I feel we've just scraped the surface, kind of just talked about what's happening and not how it affects people. As a city reporter, one of the things in terms of the tax proposals that I'm concerned about that I feel like we haven't covered nearly enough is how revenue sharing will work, because a lot of the bans, at least in the cities that I cover, the biggest issue aside from the federal preemption issue is the lack of revenue to offset what types of stuff could happen when they legalize it in their cities. And really, the legislature doesn't, I mean, if they are talking about it, the media is not covering it nearly as much. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the rolling medical into recreational, I feel that we're talking a whole lot about these stores closing or the possibility of them closing, but we haven't really discussed at the length we should how it's going to affect patients. And these patients are people who can't, I mean, they're going to these shops for a reason. They've kind of exhausted their options and traditional methods, and they're just not getting the results they need. And so if some of these stores that they've relied on for a very long time now close and they can't get the type of strain they need or whatnot, what that's going to look like and how that's going to affect them as a whole. There are a handful of recreational stores, and there's many, many, many more Green Cross stores. And I think that people are really worried, even in cities like Puyallup and Sumner that use these places a lot. They're afraid that the recreational stores won't be able to give them the same type of attention that the medical stores have, and that they're not going to be able to get the products or for the same price.
Well, I really appreciate you bringing it to our attention on all of our undercovered stories of the week. Thank you so much to our panelists, Kari Plogue, who covers East Pierce County for the Tacoma News Tribune, Justin Carter, who's founder and editor and publisher and janitor at Capitol Hill Seattle blog, and Tanya Mosley, who is an independent journalist here in Seattle and a newly minted John S. Knight Fellow. Congratulations, Tanya.
Thank you very much, Gabriel.
And thank you all for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up after the break, we're going to be talking about self-government right here on KPLU. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today we are telling tales of self-government. And I heard this story of Seattle history that kind of delighted me. So I'm going to tell it to you now. It takes place in 1962 when something very curious happened in the middle of Lake Union in Seattle. Out of nowhere, a mysterious island just emerged, just kind of rose up out of nowhere. And here's the part that I really love. A group of UW students saw an opportunity here. A self-governing, breakaway territory smack in the middle of Seattle. Kind of like the Vatican in Italy. I managed to find the ringleader of this plot.
My name is Lloyd Prunella. I live in North Kirkland at this point in our life.
And where were you up to in 1962?
I was a sophomore at the University of Washington. I lived in the Chelan house.
Now, Lloyd says that I am the first person to ask him about this in 50 years. So he broke out some of the old newspaper clippings to help jog his memory, and I asked him to spin the tale.
bunch of us were sitting around and we said, well, let's go take a look at this thing. And so we talked to this one guy who had an old LST and asked him if he'd take us out to the island.
Well, I'm sorry, what is an LST?
Oh, it's used to carry Marines as they would hit a beachhead. You've seen it in the movies where the front end will fall down and they will race onto shore. So it was a very appropriate transportation to attack this little island.
So you had, it was a little troop transport ship that you guys used to storm Seattle's newest beach.
Yes.
By beach, of course, we mean, you know, pile of muck. It was maybe 20 feet by 6 feet. It was about 300 feet off the shore. And soon after the students made that daring beach landing, they faced a question. Whose muck is it? And this turns out to be not that clear. You know, it's on a navigable waterway, but within city limits. And Lloyd, mischief maker that he was, saw a way out of this legal gray area. They would stake a mining claim. A mining claim for diatomaceous earth.
Diatomaceous earth is sort of a chalky limestone. This is sort of tongue-in-cheek, because to form diatomaceous earth would take millions of years.
As you can probably tell, this whole project was pretty tongue-in-cheek. So Lloyd and his fellow residents of the university's Chelan House named their new territory Chelan Island. And they started to get attention. Both of the daily newspapers and the student paper, too, did a bunch of stories about them. And there was all kinds of speculation about how the island came to be. It was fill dumped during freeway construction, or it was lake bottom pushed up by seismic activity or construction or something. Now, the Chelan House guys did not really care. They just knew this was a chance to found their utopia.
We had a very fun meeting, if I recall, with the House members. And we elected a mayor and a city council and a police chief and a urban planning committee and a traffic control person. So it was just good fun. One of our House members was interviewed and he said, well, they envisioned the island growing and eventually Lake Union would just be a moat around the island of Chelan.
Did you get elected to any of those offices?
I really can't recall whether I did or not.
I'm going to go ahead and just say that you were mayor.
Or adventurer.
Explorer, maybe.
Yes, explorer of unknown lands. Yeah, it didn't take too long to explore this island here.
That was Mayor Lloyd Prunella. Now, as for his jurisdiction, of course, all great empires have a rise and a fall. And Chelan Island started falling pretty much as soon as it had a name. And I mean actually falling. It sunk right back into the water after just a few weeks. And as it sunk, well, spring finals arrived, and then summer, and the citizens of Chelan Island moved on to other stuff. But somewhere down there, down in the murk, there's an old mining stake, a relic of the self-governing society that flourished ever so briefly in the middle of Lake Union. There's just something appealing about pretend government. I'm Gabriel Spitzer at Sound Effect on KPLU. We're talking today about self-government, and so we go now from a make-believe sovereign island to the make-believe one-world government. I'm joking, sort of. Rebecca Traficante has been Lebanon. She's been the Marshall Islands. She's been Israel. She has been a bunch of countries at the Model United Nations, and now she's the Secretary General of the Northwest Model UN. Of course, it works a little differently from the big UN in New York. You know, for one thing, these are generally college kids, so, you know, college humor.
People at the cookie table will make horrible puns about different countries. So it'd be like, we have Qatari-Japanese relations after drinks and dinner. Just insinuating something, right? There are a lot of really bad ones I can say.
But people there generally take it really seriously. And to give you a sense of how seriously Rebecca takes it, you should know that she is not in college. She graduated 3 years ago. So Rebecca joined us a few days ago to explain why Model UN is still such a big part of her life. And I asked her to start with the basics.
Model UN is basically LARPing. You are live action role playing a country in the UN, and you are debating and arguing and trying to come up with resolutions and trying to solve the world problems and figure out how to fix the world.
So what's the scene like at a big Model UN meeting or convention or whatever?
Everyone is dressed up in Western business attire, unless like you have a religious reason. And we have decorum, you do parliamentary procedures. There's a lot of speeches, supposedly a lot of diplomacy going on, and people trying to figure out how to solve different issues and problems.
In between the debate and the speechifying, are you breaking character?
You're not supposed to. Technically, when I hit the gavel at opening ceremonies, time freezes, and you are not who you are anymore. You are that country. So if I am Israel on the General Assembly, I am Israel in the General Assembly. I am going to be 100% representing their interests, talk like them. Anything I say can be represented of Israel. So if I say something wrong, someone, I can guarantee you, will bring that up to me in a speech and call me out for it.
Oh, fascinating. So can you kind of paint a picture of what some of the offline conversations are about? When you're at the cookie table and you're Israel and up saunters Egypt or something like that, do you guys, what do you guys do? Do you eye each other warily?
Sometimes, actually. I've definitely seen conferences where there's a turkey and a Cyprus, and the turkey and the Cyprus turn away from each other and walk the other direction like they would in the real world. So people actually do get really into character.
So if you're there in character for the whole time, gavel to gavel, do any of the animosities that surely flare up during these arguments ever stick around after the gavel falls the last time? So like in the evening, if you run into somebody at the hotel, you know, you're like, ooh. Egypt, you know, do you get that sort of sticking around in real life?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. Especially at NMUN, National Model UN in New York. It's a whole week, and you start at like 8 or 9 in the morning, and you go until 10 at night. And we had debriefings at the end of each day, and you would hear, we hate Croatia. Croatia did this. And then sometimes you go afterwards, like you'll see them at the delegate dance, or you see them afterwards, and you're like, oh my God, I just do not talk to me. So yeah, sometimes those grudges are still there.
Can you think of a time when it got especially intense or immersive and you were just really into what you were doing?
Oh, I could think of quite a few times. I was representing Israel on the Security Council, which is unheard of. Israel was never on the Security Council for lots of different reasons. And we were talking about the Arab-Israeli conflict. So it's definitely my conflict, right? And then it was the whole committee basically, besides the U.S. and U.K. attacking me. Then they decided somehow that they were going to bring a Palestinian delegate into the Security Council. Like, what is that? What is going on here? And basically, this is one of the times where people actually, including myself, got up and left because it was not, you know, fruitful for the debate. Like, what are you trying to accomplish when you're trying to incite different conflict, I guess?
Did you feel genuinely, like, outraged?
No, not really.
You were acting.
I was acting, basically. LARPing, right? LARPing.
Are there desirable countries and less desirable countries? Like when you get in there, are you hoping to get certain ones?
I think the best countries to represent are the ones that no one knows about. Because, well, one, no one knows about it, so no one could tell you you're off policy. And two, you're going to be an expert in that country anyway, so no one's going to tell you you're wrong. The hardest part is representing big, big countries like Russia, China, the U.S., U.K., because everyone knows their policies.
And you're trying to hew pretty close to their actual foreign policy. You're trying to basically say what their ambassador would say.
Yeah, basically. My favorite country to represent is the Marshall Islands. Half the world doesn't even know that country exists, right? And I love being the Marshall Islands.
Are you a big fan of the real U.N.?
No. My family hates the U.N.
So tell me about that.
I will caveat and say there are parts of the UN that I actually do like. I'm a really big fan of the WHO, the World Health Organization, and UNICEF. Overall, as a whole, there's just so much bureaucracy, and there's just so much inhibiting actual work in progress. You have these big general assemblies that create all these resolutions, but they can't do anything. There's no teeth. And then you have the Security Council, who has 15 members. Like, how in the world is 15 members going to, you know, promote the peace and security of the whole world, of all 198 member states? And unfortunately, it can't do much because it's a bunch of people who aren't willing to change.
And you said your family is also not a fan of the UN, right? Why is that?
Well, my dad was in the military for 27 years active duty, and the UN basically hampered a lot of the stuff that he had to do because he was involved in Kosovo. And so he was put in a lot of, like, missions that were coordinated with the UN. And his biggest problem was we in the United States military, or just in general, we're solving world problems or trying to create action. We make decisions in 30 minutes. The UN literally takes years.
So how do you explain to them your interest in the Model UN, given that they don't particularly care for the real UN and neither do you?
I joined Model UN to work on public speaking. I stayed in Model UN because of the education and my friends. It attracts such a weird group of people. I went to UW, and never once have I been able to sit down at a table of people where we collectively spoke 20 different languages, had anyone from super conservative to super communist and socialist at the same table, and people could sit there and talk and respect each other's ideas without there being like an argument. Now I could literally pick up the phone or email or text and contact someone pretty much in almost every continent now.
So given your hesitancy about the actual UN or your, you know, distaste for some of the problems with it, has being in Model UN given you any insight into why those problems are the way they are?
Yeah, no, of course. No one understands why the government or the state is so ineffective and why it takes so long until you start working for them. And then you figure out, oh my God, this is why it takes forever for this to happen. And it's the same thing with Model UN. You don't realize why change takes so many years until you actually sit there and you're arguing with someone over a stupid word or a few phrases and you realize that's actually what happens in the real world.
And do you think it comes down to just like democracy being messy? Or are there particular things about the way the UN is set up that make it unwieldy? Or is it more like normal human frailty or human shortcomings that make it hard to make it work?
I think pride is a big one. Nationalistic pride, human pride. Democracy is messy, but us being human just makes everything messy.
You know, our show this week is about self-government. And do you think that the United Nations, the real United Nations, restricts our self-government, restricts our ability to govern ourselves?
If we're American, no. And that's because we foot 75% of the bill for the UN. Other countries, yeah, it definitely does. Like Haiti, for example. It's a war-torn country where there's the coup, then it has natural disasters happening, and their life support is the UN. The peacekeepers there, all of the humanitarian support, and all of the, agendas that are going through Haiti is definitely, stopping them to be self-governed. But if you're in the United States, you're more likely to be governed by your state politician than you are the UN.
Well, Rebecca Traficante is the Secretary General of the Northwest Model United Nations, and she'll be presiding over the Seattle 2015 conference in November. Madam Secretary, thanks for being on Sound Effect.
All right, thank you.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This week, we are talking about self-government. So the usual thinking about how to help an addict heal has to do with giving up control. It's right there in step one of the classic 12-step program. Admit you are powerless over your addiction. There's an apartment building in Seattle where addicts are trying something different. They are getting more control over their lives. And they're getting results. KPLU's Jennifer Wing went there to hear some of their stories.
Alan Sarant is a bearded, balding man of average height with a large middle. He wears a t-shirt, shorts, and flip-flops. He's an alcoholic, and he's drunk. His life began to unravel decades ago. Things got really bad when his third marriage ended.
I left my wife for another woman. That's the official reason. The primary reason I left her for my original love, which was alcohol.
Sarant doesn't have hangovers anymore.
I have withdrawals. I feel them. It hurts. And I don't like that at all.
Sarant is one of the 74 people who live at 1811 East Lake in Seattle. It's tucked into the concrete armpit of I-5 and the Denny Overpass. To get a place here, you have to be homeless, and you must be addicted to alcohol. Most chronic alcoholics are middle-aged men, and the population at 1811 reflects that. Sarant is 55 years old, and he's a binge drinker.
It's like, right now as we're talking, I'm in the midst of a binge. It's kind of like the snake in the box thing. You have to just open up that damn box to see if the snake's still there. And I have a bad habit of doing that.
These folks, for the most part, are never going to get sober. What are we going to do with them?
That's Bill Hobson. He's the head of DESC, the nonprofit that oversees 1811 East Lake.
If you are over 45 years of age, if you have a minimum of 15 years of street alcohol addiction history under your belt, and you have six or more failed attempts at conventional treatment, you have less than a 4% chance of getting sober for the remainder of your life.
Think about that. The odds are heavily stacked against someone like Alan Sarant.
Do we want to continue to see them oscillate endlessly through jails and emergency departments, eating up public revenue resources, or should we be thinking about something different?
If removing alcohol isn't realistic, Hobson thought the thing that could be fixed was housing. Remove the chaos of homelessness from the equation. Where will I sleep? Where's the next meal coming from? Who's going to steal my stuff? What would happen if that stress and uncertainty was gotten rid of and this population was allowed to drink as much as it wanted?
There was a 30% reduction in alcohol consumption.
30%? That's a lot. Alcoholics on the street, when they're homeless, they buy their beverage of choice and they drink it immediately. They know their friends will want to share it with them, or a police officer will confiscate it and make them pour it out. But once you live in a housing project,
you can put your bottle or your beer on the shelf or the beer in the fridge and consume at your leisure, the way everybody else who's housed, if they consume alcohol, consumes alcohol. We're convinced that that actually was the principal reason for the reduction.
Now, just to be clear, alcohol still has a tight grip on people like Sarant, but researchers at the University of Washington say the residents at 1811 East Lake have gone from having 20 drinks a day to about 12. And for Sarant and others who need extra help, 1811 has something called an alcohol management program. A certain number of drinks, usually six, are handed out on a schedule at the front desk.
And I like just having that six a day.
This prevents residents from wandering the streets in search of beer and liquor. It keeps them out of trouble. Studies out of the University of Washington showed that when this population makes fewer visits to jails and emergency rooms, it ends up saving Seattle and King County more than $4 million a year. For a handful of residents, having a stable, safe home that didn't ask them to kick their habit didn't just result in them tapering off. It jolted them awake. They made the decision on their own to get completely sober. Roger Field is one of these people. A switch flipped inside him once he had his own apartment with a door he could lock. A few years ago, he was a mess.
But I drank my way out of the Air Force in 4 months.
Field had a wife, stepkids, a house, a car, a decent job. He lost everything because of his drinking. He lived on the streets in Seattle for years, making lots of trips to Harborview's emergency room. When he got into 1811, he doesn't remember anything about what his first 4 months here were like. And then,
in March of 2010, I had my last drink. And the epiphany was, it wasn't working anymore. It wasn't doing what I wanted to do, so there's no point in doing it. And it takes a long time to do that, believe me. The alcohol will tell you something different.
Field is still sober. He's one of only about a dozen people who have ever been able to do this since 1811 opened back in 2005. It's rare. He is one of the 4%. Field is welcome to stay at 1811 for as long as he wants. He has counselors and social workers available 24 hours a day to support him. He has a job cold calling people and asking for donations for the nonprofit Sight Connections for the Blind. His mind is busy. He wants to make up for lost time, and he'd like to earn more money.
I wouldn't mind just a bookkeeping job or a library job.
Field is learning how to manage his emotions.
I found out that it actually feels better to smile It feels better to not fly off the handle because I actually feel get a good feeling when I don't. It's like success.
He doesn't feel sorry for himself as much as he used to.
I don't give up quite as easily anymore. I'm working on it. It's a struggle, but it's worth it.
He makes it a point to tell me that he owns a TV, a computer, and an iPod. He doesn't want to come across as bragging. The presence of these devices in his personal space is a reminder he's still choosing to be sober. Back when he blindly wandered Seattle's streets, he would have sold everything to buy the next drink. By watching people like Field and other residents who have cut back on the bottle, Noah Fay is learning a lot about how positive change happens.
We need to let our clients' own motivations be what drives outcomes, and it's our job to help kind of steer in the right direction.
Fay is the program's project manager, the lead social worker. Based on what he's seen at 1811, forcing people to quit drinking just doesn't work.
I mean, no one likes to be told what to do.
He says lasting change only sticks when it's completely self-motivated.
Being told what to do puts people on the defensive and doesn't get at the root underlying motivation that really drives change. People can get better, but you have to allow them the room to do it themselves.
Alan Sorant, who we met earlier, who's going through a binge, has tried to get sober many times without much success. But even when he stumbles around intoxicated, just knowing that sobriety is an option is a comfort to him.
I like the idea that when I wake up in the morning, there's a good chance I'm going to spend the day sober. I like that that opportunity is there for me.
Sorant says as bad as he might be, he'd be a lot worse if not for this place.
Hell, for all I know, the reason I'm alive is because of this place.
For now, Sorant has no plans to quit drinking.
That story from KPLU's Jennifer Wing. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We are thinking about self-government today and how it is that we learn to govern ourselves. We become autonomous people. It's part of growing up, but some people do it earlier than others, including a certain percentage of the population under the age of 18 who decide to become adults legally. And one of them is joining me now. His name is Logan Hoffkamp. He lives in Santa Monica now, but he grew up near Bellingham, Washington. And Logan, how old are you now?
I'm 23 years old.
And how old were you when you became emancipated?
I believe I just turned 16, maybe a few months into being 16.
So for starters, maybe you can just explain, what is emancipation and what does it entitle you to?
So becoming an emancipated minor is basically divorcing your parents and becoming your own legal guardian, whereas you basically have the power of attorney and you are basically a legal adult in terms of being able to sign documents and govern yourself. You obviously can't buy alcohol or vote or anything like that.
So what was going on in your life at that time that got you interested in this?
Well, my mom had moved away to another state, so she wasn't around a ton. And I was living with my brother and in my father's house. Things were a little rocky. I was kind of a rebellious teenager. I was doing things that he wasn't super excited about, obviously. And we were butting heads. We were kind of getting in fights, getting in arguments. I was, dad just kind of was fighting me on some things. I decided to just kind of take off and do my own thing. And then, it just kind of escalated to that point. I wasn't really aware of it until one day my boss kind of had mentioned that I can do this to work more hours.
So how did you do it? Like, what are the steps you have to go through?
I filed with the courthouse. And then I had to prove that I had good grades in school, that I was in good standing at that point, that I was living on my own and able to support myself. They'll let you say goodbye as long as you can prove it on paper that you're all right, that you have your own mailing address, that you're not out doing drugs, that you're not out, you're not out just basically causing trouble, as long as you're like a young, mature adult and you look like you've got a plan. I would assume that my idea of going to school rather than working in, a retail store for the rest of my life was probably pretty beneficial to it.
To what extent were you really that person you were portraying yourself as, somebody who was really organized and had a plan and probably in much better shape to parent yourself than your own biological parents were?
I would like to say that I was kind of able to, but nowhere near as well as my parents could have, to be completely honest. Obviously, I mean, there's so much wisdom in being quite a bit older than somebody, and it's just like you just don't have that wisdom when you're 16. I made it through it, and I made it through it pretty well, but I would say in all honesty, you're probably much better off having a parent figure. I definitely grew up way too fast, and I feel like I missed out on a lot of, like, you know, my high school experience, and even part of, like, you know, part of college. I missed out on a big part of college just working, and I feel like I never really got to have those, you know, awesome summer vacations or, you know, any of that stuff where you just kind of lay around and do nothing with no worries. I feel like I missed a good 4 years of my life of not having to worry. I kind of cashed that in to be on my own.
How did your dad take all of this? Even though you had something of a rocky relationship, was he okay with it when you told him that you wanted to declare emancipation?
He certainly fought me on it. He did not think it was a good idea. And obviously it reflects, I mean, just from the outside, I mean, if you just out of context thought, you know, somebody divorced their parents, it sounds very, very bad. And it, you know, probably doesn't reflect the best. But, you know, after a bit of talking, a bit of fighting and going back and forth, I think it eventually became kind of a mutual benefit to both of us. You know, to be quite honest, I kind of feel bad about it now.
You feel bad about it because you feel like it hurt his feelings?
Yeah, I definitely feel like it hurt his feelings. And I mean, how could it not hurt somebody's feelings?
So can you see it more from his point of view now than you could then? And if so, what's different?
I would say every day I get older, I see it more and more from his point of view. I mean, I'm certainly glad I did it. And I think he's certainly glad I did it in the long run. But, you know, I had one side of my parents, my mother, who was kind of like basically telling me I could, you know, do what I want and things like this. And, you know, I was kind of on my own and, you know, just do whatever you want. Everything's good. And then I had my dad, who's a very kind of like strict, straight, stand-up kind of guy. And, you know, I feel like I should have listened to him a lot more instead of my mother. And we just kind of started mending fences. The more I saw how often, you know, his idea was right or it was kind of the right way to do things was his way, I think I kind of became closer to him, and now I really look up to him.
Did you have some kind of a ID that showed that you were emancipated, that you were no ordinary teenager? Oh no, you were a miniature adult?
I didn't exactly have an ID. I mean, I had a paper form, and I guess I could show it to somebody, and I have shown it to some of the girls that I had dated at the time, and I don't know, maybe that helped, but it's certainly an awkward thing because it's the law, and that's not really clear either if you can, you know, date somebody who's over 20 if you're under 17 and emancipated. It was just kind of an awkward thing. I mean, I had to explain to a lady that, you know, she wasn't going to go to jail if she slept with me, only if somebody decided to press charges, and that somebody would have to be me. It's a very weird, weird thing. I don't think she was super into it, if that makes sense.
Well, Logan Hofkamp grew up outside Bellingham, Washington. He became an emancipated youth at the age of 16. And now about 7 years later, he's down in Southern California doing kind of a crazy job. He rents out Lamborghinis and brokers chartered yachts and things like that. So he seems to have done okay for himself. Logan, thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you, Gabriel. Really appreciate it. And it's a pleasure talking to you.
Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix, Kevin Kniestead, and Matthew Strive. We had reporting this week from Jennifer Wing. Thanks also to David Williams, who wrote about Chelan Island for HistoryLink. We had web help from Mike Lewis, and our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can find our podcast at iTunes, and Arwen will be your best friend if you write a review. You can also heap praise or abuse on us at soundeffect@kplu.org or tweet at KPLU. Be back here next week when we'll be naming names. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is 88.5 KPLU.